All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. Our next guest is Phil Giraldi. He's the executive director of the Council for the National Interest, contributing editor at the American Conservative Magazine, and regular columnist for antiwar.com, also a former CIA and DIA counterterrorism officer. Welcome back to the show, Phil. How are you doing?
I'm okay, Scott. How about you?
I'm doing pretty good. Appreciate you joining us today.
No problem.
All right, so I'm looking at the BBC here, and it says, Syria unrest, bloodiest day as troops fire on rallies. I was wondering if you could give us the background, basically, on who's who in power in Syria, who's doing the protesting, and maybe the last couple of weeks worth of what have you.
Well, I think the protest is kind of following the pattern of what we saw in other places, that basically this is kind of a educated, younger crowd with different expectations, although there are a lot of what might be described as more middle-class types, professionals that are supporting it too. There's a whole gamut of political objectives here, but basically I think it's like everywhere else where it's the objective is regime change. As to how strong it really is and to what extent it goes beyond certain ethnic and tribal groups in Syria is a little bit hard to say.
Yeah, well, of course, there's got to be all different factors at play here. Now, is the State Department, the CIA, running around giving millions of dollars to people? Is this like 1953 where you kind of take advantage of some discontent, manufacture some more, and try to get a pressure from above and below kind of reaction going on?
I don't think the CIA is doing much of anything, but the... But certainly USAID has been up to tricks and has been funding opposition movements, opposition newspapers, radio transmissions, that kind of thing. National Endowment for Democracy, I wouldn't be too surprised if they've been conducting training programs somewhere for Syrians. These things are this is what the CIA used to do back in the old days of the Bay of Pigs, and now we do this stuff overtly, that our arrogance has increased to such a level that we think that we can interfere anywhere at any time without any retribution.
Mm. Well, and I guess they sort of package it like it's all just a big, Soros pro-free election type movement, right? Oh, we're just here to promote democracy. We're not saying we're choosing who or anything or what your policy should be.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they definitely package it as pro-democracy, as pro-freedom. You know, these are the buzzwords. But, of course, it has a political agenda because these places all have governments, and the governments represent a certain constituency inside the country, and we're saying that constituency and what these governments represent is illegitimate. While at the same time we have an embassy in the place and an ambassador in the place that is conceding that they are legitimate. So it's the ultimate hypocrisy.
Well, you know, there was a piece in the New York Times, I guess, late last week, maybe it was early this week, that it sort of seemed to me like they were trying to do a little bit of revisionist history and kind of, make the State Department seem like the good guy in a way. But the piece was about how, really it was the State Department that encouraged the revolution in Egypt, too, and all these people who were leaders of the revolution, we helped them and all that. And now I know there was that one cable from WikiLeaks where the Telegraph, I think, tried to, make it seem like the CIA or the State Department was really behind the April 6th movement, and I think Justin Raimondo pretty well debunked that on a closer reading of the cable. And I'm not sure if the Times story was referring to just that anecdote or others, but they were basically saying that, we've been sowing seeds of democracy in Egypt all along. I wonder whether you think, I don't want to assume there's a coherent policy here in my question, Phil, but is it possible that they really had decided that, Mubarak's 82, something's got to be done, he's going to die sooner or later anyway, so, maybe they're, helping or were helping the Egyptian revolution the same way they're doing in Syria now?
Well, I think the fact is that there is, as you're alluding to, there is no coherent policy in any of this stuff. I mean, basically, the State Department was completely in bed with all these people up until it became clear that this revolution was for real. And but at the same time, we had...
And then they turned right back to Suleiman, right?
Yeah, exactly. And but at the same time, we had the National Endowment for Democracy training people in Cyprus and places like that to go back into Egypt and to teach them how to do these Twitter revolutions, basically. So, you know, one hand either doesn't know what the other hand is doing, or they do know, and it's just a totally hypocritical policy.
Mm. Well, you know, that Times article really did smack of trying to take credit for something that was really not their doing. You know, it seemed to me like, well, and I guess this is the thing, though, right? You're a former CIA guy. That's how you do the plot, right? You find a parade, you get in front of it and lead it the way you want it to go. So if there's a giant April 6th movement, give them a couple of $1 million if you can. I'm not accusing them of that. I don't know. But I'm just saying you go in there, you find people worth infiltrating, and you infiltrate them.
Well, I think that, yeah, that's the theory, but, you know, it's become a lot more difficult in practice because I think a lot of these young people are a lot more savvy now, and they pretty quickly recognize when they're being used by the United States or one of the European powers. And as a result, I think that, yeah, they're taking credit for stuff that really only happened because the local people took their fate in their hands and decided to do something. And then, of course, the people like Hillary Clinton are not going to be slow to get in front of this. I guess you noticed that John McCain has been in Benghazi, you know, rooting for the rebels and asking for more American aid. And, of course, Obama immediately obliged him by unleashing the Predator drones.
That's funny. And he hadn't been there since 2 years ago when he went to shake hands and firm up a weapons deal with Muammar Gaddafi.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Somehow that got, you know, omitted from the coverage on TV of his great trip over there.
Yeah, well, he's a great patriot.
Yeah, he says these rebels are his heroes. I wonder if anybody asked him if that included the guys that went and fought against the American soldiers as part of Al-Qaeda in Iraq a couple of years back.
Well, his attention span is not long enough to remember that.
Yeah, well, and he's pretty sure Al-Qaeda and Iraq's hiding in Iran right now anyway, right? So.
Well, together with all the weapons of mass destruction.
Right, yeah. Well, and of course, in Syria, too. The Russians helped to move it all to Syria. That's why we can't find it. Well, so, and speaking of which, I wonder, well, okay, so we're taking into account that there's not too much coherence behind much of this and that kind of thing, but do they really want to see a regime change in Syria? I mean, who do they think would be easier for the Israelis and our own government to work with than the Alawite Ba'athist dictatorship there?
Yeah, that's the issue, isn't it? I mean, if you're real looking at realpolitik and at self-interest, then obviously Assad is a good guy to be dealing with. He has been in control. He basically would love to come to some kind of peace agreement with the Israelis, and he would like to have a better relationship with us. You know, so the whole thing is crazy from any kind of self-interest point of view, but that's not going to stop it. I think what, if anything, might stop it is the fact that I think the Israelis will probably get very, very nervous very quickly and urge their American friends to do what they can to calm it down, because the Israeli interest clearly is you know, not to have any kind of confrontational state right on your border. And well, you know, that might be the issue.
Sweet. We're relying on the rationality and the calm, good judgment of the Likudniks in Benjamin Netanyahu's office now.
That's right. Yeah, we in this case we would have to be doing that. Yeah.
Wow. This is like that time that we're, you know, George Bush checked Dick Cheney on starting the war with Iran in 2007, or Admiral Fallon checked George Bush for that matter. This is not where I like to look for my checks and balances, Phil. It's not supposed to be this way.
Well, you know, there used to be kind of a rationality to foreign policy, but I guess that's gone, and it's now a question of various competing interest groups. I guess in a sense it always was that way, but a national interest of some kind seemed to override the interest groups, and now the interest groups are the ones that call the shots.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, you know, that whole clean break, expedite the chaotic collapse type policy that David Wilmser and Richard Perle wrote up was for Netanyahu back in 96. You think it's possible that they, you know, that Netanyahu would like to see Syria tear itself apart and stay that way for a while like Iraq has?
Well, I think, yeah, they would like to see all of the Arab states dissolve into chaos.
I guess that's what I'm reading in the Washington Post. Chaotic collapse being expedited by the State Department. All right, well, great. Hang tight. I got more good questions, and he's got more good answers. It's Phil Giraldi from Antiwar.com and the Council for the National Interest. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Phil Giraldi. He's a former CIA and DIA officer and is the executive director of the Council for the National Interest Foundation, the America Lobby in D.C. He's a contributing editor of the American Conservative Magazine and a regular columnist for antiwar.com. And we're talking about what's going on in Syria, and especially as regards to what's going on in Netanyahu's office over there. So which is it, Phil? You think that Netanyahu would prefer to see the Alawite minority hold on to their Baathist dictatorship in Syria for the time being, or go ahead and expedite that chaotic collapse, as David Wormser said, and turn the place upside down from here on out?
Well, I think, you know, there's an argument to be made to go either way. Obviously, when you have somebody that you can deal with that is in control, it simplifies your problems with dealing with an adversary. But at the same time, you don't want that adversary to be too strong, because then he poses a threat. So there's an advantage there, but there's also an advantage to see Syria kind of break down into its constituent parts. The danger of that, of course, would be that somebody might take control eventually that is really hostile to Israel. So, you know, they're obvious. This is, I think, obviously the triangulation that's going on inside Israel, and probably to a certain extent is also going on inside Washington, in terms of, you know, what the end game is here, what you wind up with, and just how dangerous it is. I mean, obviously, the United States really doesn't have a horse in this race, that that Syria, no matter which way it turns, is not going to be a threat to the United States. But for Israel, obviously, it's a more serious issue.
Well, you know, if you were Israeli and working for Netanyahu, an advisor to him, do you know of any good reasons why they shouldn't just have a permanent peace treaty with Syria and work things out with all their neighbors? It seems to me like this whole clean break policy is very counterproductive. I mean, hell, with dealing with Assad Jr. there in Syria, they could probably continue on in the West Bank the way they are and still have a peace deal with him, you know?
Yeah, but of course they'd have to give up the Golan Heights. That's the crunch issue, that there's a strong constituency in Israel not to give them up. So I think that's kind of the issue as it comes down. I don't think anyone thinks that Syria is a serious military threat against Israel, and certainly a peace treaty with them would make a lot of sense. It's come very close a couple of times. I'm sure you recall there was they were doing some negotiating through an Israeli businessman and a Syrian government official back a couple of years ago, and they were on the verge of having an agreement. But the negotiations were exposed, and it became a political issue, and it kind of went away.
Right. Well, and I think part of the story was that Bush and Rice objected and said, no, don't deal with the Syrians.
Yeah, that's right. I had forgotten that aspect, but that's correct, yeah.
What a strange relationship this country and that one have, huh?
Well, it's a relationship that's impossible to explain in most real terms. The relationship makes no sense. Obviously, Israel needs the United States for action at the UN, for money, for a number of other things. But it doesn't really like us a whole lot as a result. And the United States is just basically in a position where it's manipulated by a domestic lobby. I think you probably saw the notice going around that there's a motion in the House of Representatives now to withhold UN payments until the UN repudiates the Goldstone report. This kind of stuff is crazy. It has nothing to do with U.S. interests.
Mm. Well, and also going through the UN right now, I'm not sure what stage it's at, but there's a movement to just, a bunch of states in South America at least already have recognized Palestine as a state, and it seems like more and more are doing that. There's a push to go ahead and say one way or another this is going to be resolved. Do you think that that's going anywhere? I mean, after all, Obama said that that was his goal when he took office.
Well, I mean, also going around the internet, there are some memos that have been circulating among the Jewish organizations in an attempt to forestall this and to try to stop it. And of course, there's a tremendous pressure on Congress to use whatever force Congress can use to stop Palestine from declaring itself a nation in September when the UN General Assembly opens again, and it has overwhelming support. I mean, they're only probably the only two countries in the world that would oppose it are Israel and the United States. So, and then it's questionable what the U.S. could do in the Security Council to make it even more difficult. They probably couldn't do a whole lot. But the fact is that, there's a growing momentum for it. It wouldn't really change anything on the ground, but it certainly would change a lot of the way people are looking at the conflict.
You think, I guess back to the reasonableness of Benjamin Netanyahu, do you think that there's a chance that he would ever end the occupation and say that, look, the best long-term interests of Israel is to end the occupation?
No. I think the short answer is Netanyahu is the type of nationalist, and he's got the type of government in terms of extreme right-wing influences that make it impossible for him to say that. He's going to be addressing Congress next month, and I think he's going to, you know, lay out what he will call a peace plan, but it will be something that is so convoluted and has so many conditions on it that he knows perfectly well that it's something that will never be realized.
Right, yeah, we'll call it a state, but they can't have their own foreign policy, and we'll collect all their taxes for them and be their police, and it'll be an occupation in everything but name now.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it will be. It will be demilitarized. It will basically be a state without any of the prerogatives of a state, and that turns it into like a Helot class for ancient Sparta, where there's you have like a labor supply if you choose to use it. That exists there that's completely under your control.
I guess I want to change subject a little bit, although, you know, our relationship with Israel is part of this too. I wonder if you think if, you know, I Dream a Genie made it all happen somehow. We know the system is broken, that ain't going to do it. But if Ron Paul was the president and did exactly like he said and just abolished the empire and ordered every military commander to pack up his things and come home from everywhere in the world and completely changed our foreign policy in that way, what would be the risks? I mean, you're a former CIA guy. Give us a realistic thing. Would America be in danger if we didn't have the biggest, most powerful Navy, Air Force, nuclear weapons stockpile, et cetera, like that?
Well, we still could have all that stuff, but we just have it here at home. And I don't think the United States necessarily would be threatened by withdrawing from these places. I think that you have to look at every single place and every single situation to see what the U.S. interests really are in these places. I mean, we do have certain interests, like we do have an interest in there being relatively free trade around the world. We have an interest, in particular, since we're a heavily energy dependent country, that energy flows should be regulated by the market, that we should have access to energy. So we do have international interests that have to be protected in certain ways. But the fact is we don't have to be an imperial power as we currently are and serving as a policeman in places like Libya.
Well, and speaking of Libya, we only have a couple of minutes here, but I just wonder if you still maintain that exact same pessimism that I have about the very long-term nature of this thing, the painted into the corner aspect of it that the Democrats have gotten this country into now.
I fear it's going to be one of these situations like the Balkans, where it just seems to go on and on and on. It's not a real war in that you don't have masses of troops invading the country and occupying it or anything like that. I think Obama would not go along that way. But the fact is, I think, you know, it's like you get involved with these things and you get enmeshed in them, and suddenly there's no way out. And I have a feeling that that's where we're heading. My fear is that, you know, this is the fact that he's taking this kind of initiative in Libya, where we had no real reason to do so, might be suggestive of the fact that he'll be doing similar things in other places like Yemen and maybe Syria.
So then I guess I'm stuck with, in my limited experience, the Iraq model of Bill Clinton in the 1990s, permanent blockade, but no real regime change, just permanent blockade till he dies of old age or the Republicans get elected again.
Yeah, that's kind of the pattern of these things. The Democrats are...
I'd almost prefer they went ahead and sent in the Marines and just get it over with.
Actually, that might be a better solution. The fact that these wars go on forever is the discouraging part. I mean, how many years we've been in Iraq now, Afghanistan, starting in Libya now. It's just that the pattern is repeated over and over again.
Doomed. Doomed, I tells you. Well, you know, here's the thing. Charles Goyette was saying yesterday he was drawing the contrast between the real issues facing this country and how much trouble we're really in compared to the narrative and how more and more and more people are getting it. The contrast is just too black and white. The obvious issues that right, left, and libertarian real people out here in the country have in common are so obvious. You know, the corporate welfare, the world empire, the destruction of our Bill of Rights and our free markets, you know, such as they were anyway. And then the prerogatives of the bipartisan consensus up there in D.C., which is to do all of these horrible things. It's getting more and more stark, and I think, you know, the Ron Paul revolution this time around is the best hope we have for, if you know, not really changing the way things are in D.C., certainly changing the way the American people see these divisions, kind of in a once-and-for-all sort of an actually-get-it-done kind of a way, you know?
I agree with that.
I sure hope so. It's the only hope I have, really, Phil. All right. Well, listen, man, I appreciate your time, as always.
Great stuff. No problem, Scott. Take care.
All right. Thanks a lot. Have a good one. All right, everybody. That is Phil Giralli, former CIA and DIA officer, executive director of the Council for the National Interest Foundation, the America Lobby in Washington, D.C., writes for the American Conservative, amcommag.com, and, of course, at antiwar.com/Giralli.